Good morning. Hong Kong's government considers a law that would send people charged with crimes to mainland China, and violent protests have been breaking out in the streets in response. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Despite the public outcry, Hong Kong's leader suggests that she will move ahead. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. No tariffs for Mexico, but the U.S. trade war with China goes on, and now the American economy is starting to feel new effects. Also this hour, a new book that takes us into the day-to-day life of an American spy in Russia. What trauma has to do with chronic pain, and the results of Broadway's biggest night bring wins for old favorites and new talent. It is Monday, June 10th. President Obama's younger daughter, Sasha, turns 18 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump is cautioning that while the U.S. and Mexico have reached agreement in principle on migration, he says he could renew the threat of tariffs on Mexican products coming into the U.S. It's unclear if the plan to lower the number of migrants will work. Further, some of the concessions Mexico agreed to in the new accord were agreements Mexican officials had already made in the past. That included making more asylum seekers stay in Mexico while they wait for U.S. court hearings. 19 Democratic presidential candidates gave speeches at a single event in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, on Sunday. Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters has more.
The most notable absence from the lineup was Joe Biden. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York made a swipe at the former vice president regarding abortion without saying his name. Biden recently reversed his opinion and now supports repealing the Hyde Amendment. That bans most uses of federal funds to pay for abortions.
I don't think there is room in our party for a Democratic candidate who does not support women's full reproductive freedom.
And Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders made a case against being a moderate candidate.
That approach is not just bad public policy, but it is a failed political strategy.
Biden came in first in a major Iowa poll over the weekend. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
High winds and dry conditions in Northern California have firefighters and the country's largest utility on alert. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, Bob Moffitt reports.
Half a dozen fires started this weekend, with the largest burning in Yolo County, west of Sacramento. The area was under a National Weather Service red flag warning as temperatures rose into the 90s amid windy conditions. Pacific Gas and Electric executed precautionary power outages in the Napa area and in Butte County, just west of the site of last November's campfire. PG&E spokeswoman Ari Van Renen says once the power is shut off, there's a time-consuming process to turn it back on.
We have our crews in the field go out to visually inspect all of the power lines and infrastructure. And once they do those safety inspections, then we'll turn the power back on for customers.
Evacuation centers were available near each community impacted by power outages. For NPR News, I'm Bob Moffitt in Sacramento.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says he's considering direct engagement with Chinese President Xi Jinping, this to end a diplomatic squabble between the two countries. Dan Karpinchuk has more.
Relations deteriorated after Canada detained a Chinese high-tech executive in December on an extradition request by the U.S. Following that, China arrested two Canadians, cut imports of canola seed from Canada, and is now threatening to increase inspections of Canadian pork products. While attending D-Day ceremonies, Trudeau said he's contemplating direct engagement with the Chinese leader, and that might come at the G20 meeting in Osaka, Japan, at the end of the month.
Dan Karpinchuk reporting. It's NPR. There's a huge merger in the defense industry. Raytheon Company and United Technologies Corporation will combine, and it's expected the merged company could see as much as $74 billion in sales this year. Raytheon makes missiles such as the Patriot system. United Technologies produces products for the aerospace and building sectors, from airplane engines to spacesuits. Action at the Women's World Cup in France on Sunday had both tension and excitement. There were three interesting matches in the wide-open soccer tournament. NPR's Laurel Walmsley reports.
With the Women's World Cup now firmly underway, the group stage games are coming fast and furious, each one a chance to see which squads live up to the hype and which teams choke under the pressure. The tournament's third day brought two expected results and one surprise. Australia's highly regarded Matildas were upset by an Italian goal in stoppage time that left them with a 2-1 loss. England outmatched Scotland in a hotly anticipated rivalry, and World Cup debutante Jamaica fell to Brazil, which fared well despite missing an injured Marta, thanks to a hat trick from Cristiani. The result would have been more lopsided if not for the skill of Jamaica's 19-year-old goalkeeper, Sydney Schneider. The U.S. plays its first game on Tuesday against Thailand. Laurel Wamsley, NPR News, Reims, France.
Former Boston Red Sox All-Star player David Ortiz has been shot in the Dominican Republic. Witnesses say he was attacked by a gunman in a bar in Santo Domingo who shot him in the back. David Ortiz's father says his son is out of danger. The apparent gunman was captured by a crowd and beaten. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Viking, dedicated to bringing the traveler closer to the destination. Viking's new custom-built ocean fleet offers a small ship experience with all veranda staterooms and shore excursions in every port. VikingCruises.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Let's linger for a moment on the sound of protest. Demonstrators in Hong Kong brought instruments into the streets and called their government useless, although their sheer numbers speak more powerfully than what exactly they said. Now, as you listen, picture a mass of people on a major street filling all the space between skyscrapers for as far as you can see. Some of them chanted no extradition, which is the issue here. Hong Kong is part of China, but still has an independent judiciary. It's left over from British colonial times, and China committed to preserve that when the British left. The extradition law, if passed, would make it easier for mainland China to take suspects away into its own much less transparent system. Natasha Khan of the Wall Street Journal is covering this story from Hong Kong. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Dave. It's good to be here.
What have you seen?
Yesterday was a pretty extraordinary day in Hong Kong. As you described, it was really one of those things where, you know, it was the only thing people were talking about, and, you know, it really caused gridlock in the northern part of the city, and it was just, people in white shirts, which was the dress code, holding up red placards, you know, all day, and, you know, walking for 7 hours from a park to the government headquarters, you know, patiently. You know, if you can imagine a million people walking through the street, you know, it's quite a line, basically.
Who would be affected if this law were to take effect?
I think basically, you know, it could take effect in a few weeks. And the fear is that, you know, China could use this agreement to, you know, extradite people, let's say, that they don't really like to China for trial. And as you had mentioned, you know, the legal system is much more opaque there.
Are there a lot of people who are critics of the Chinese government who are on the outs in some way, who have effectively taken refuge in Hong Kong?
Yes, there's quite a lot of, I think Hong Kong has always been a haven for dissent. And, you know, here in Hong Kong, there's the freedom of protest, freedom of expression, which is much more limited in China. So a lot of people are worried that under the pretense of another, you know, trumped up charges, basically, that they could then be extradited back to China.
Well, would they still get a hearing? Would they still get a hearing in Hong Kong's more independent judicial system before they disappeared into China?
The government has stressed very strongly that that would happen. Again, I think here critics say that, you know, for example, in the case of a bookseller that disappeared from Hong Kong a few years ago, you know, it seemed that the crime he was charged for in China was quite different from what, you know, might have put him in the crosshairs of the Chinese government.
Oh, and this is a person who disappeared without judicial proceedings, even without this law that has not yet been passed. I want to ask one quick question. I want to ask one quick question before we go, though, Natasha Khan. We've had these huge protests, but as I understand it, the chief executive of Hong Kong is appointed by mainland China. So does anybody in Hong Kong's government need to listen to a million protesters?
Well, I guess it then goes back to who a city's leader should be accountable to. So I think that's really at the heart of what the protesters were shouting about yesterday. So, you know, you could see a lot of people calling for the leader to step down because exactly what you're pointing out to, which is that, you know, who is she supposed to be serving? You know, that it should be for the people, but unfortunately they feel that she is not doing that and instead really trying to please Beijing.
But she can stay the course.
But for now it seems to be the case, yes.
Natasha Khan of The Wall Street Journal, thanks so much.
When CIA officers walk out of the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, they are shadowed everywhere by Russian security. When they go to stores, to restaurants, to and from their apartments.
You couldn't have an argument with your husband or your wife. You couldn't turn around without them knowing.
That is the voice of Jonna Mendez. She and her husband, Tony Mendez, who died earlier this year, have a new book out. It is titled The Moscow Rules, and it opens a rare window into how the CIA works in the Russian capital. Here's NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie.
As a young government employee in 1975, Marty Peterson was assigned to the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. She loved the social scene, and it earned her a nickname.
I was known as Party Marty because I was out socializing with the Marine Guard, with younger secretaries, the single social life.
Peterson was actually with the CIA, the first woman officer sent to Moscow. Her cover was to be a fun-loving clerical worker, someone Soviet security could safely ignore as it obsessively tracked actual and suspected CIA officers. Her mission was to handle one of the most valuable Soviet sources the CIA had ever cultivated, a foreign ministry worker who saw the incoming cables from every Soviet embassy in the world.
So we got a huge insight into what the Soviets were planning, what their intentions were, what their negotiating points were before we even sat down with them.
Peterson and her source, codenamed Trigon, communicated by dead drops in the dead of night, often at a Moscow park. She would place a fake log with messages inside. He'd show up an hour later and drop a rusty can or an old oily glove. Tucked inside was film of top secret documents he'd photographed with a miniature camera. Peterson never saw those photos, but U.S. presidents did.
We just knew that we were picking up gold off the street.
We'll return to her story in a moment. It's one of many spy tales in a new book, The Moscow Rules, by Tony and Jonna Mendez, a couple who both had long careers at the CIA. She offers a sampling of those rules.
You are never alone. Don't trust anyone. No one. Not the little lady in the restroom who's sweeping out the stalls, not the flower girl in the corner. You just didn't trust anyone in Moscow.
The CIA considered it too risky to recruit Soviet citizens inside the country. They were recruited abroad, and when they returned to the Soviet Union, communication was never direct.
For many, many years, we never met face-to-face because we thought it was too dangerous.
At separate points, Tony and Jonna Mendez each served as chief of disguise at the CIA. They were part of the Office of Technical Services.
we were the equivalent of Q in the James Bond movies.
Tony Mendez, who died in January, is best known for a previous book he wrote, Argo, which became the Oscar-winning movie of the same name. Ben Affleck portrayed Mendez, who guided trapped American diplomats out of revolutionary Iran in 1980. The couple was never based in Moscow, but traveled there to help CIA officers operate in the city. The main Soviet security agency, then known as the KGB, made that as difficult as possible, says Oleg Kalugin. He's a former KGB officer who became a critic of the Soviet system, and he now lives outside Washington.
The Soviet KGB was a strong, powerful organization.
To escape KGB surveillance, Tony Mendez developed one technique called disguise on the run.
He had started a businessman in a raincoat and a briefcase.
He turned the raincoat inside out, and it became a pink woman's overcoat. He pulled up his pant legs, revealing black stockings. He put on a mask and a wig of an elderly woman. The briefcase sprouted wheels. In just 45 seconds,
he ended up an old woman in a pink coat, wearing a shawl, with gray hair coming out, pushing a grocery cart. And it was just kind of an amazing transformation.
Tony Mendez worked with some of Hollywood's top makeup artists to refine his skills. Jana Mendez would develop the tiny rolls of film provided by the agency's Soviet spies.
You'd think about the people that had risked their lives to get that information on film, and you'd just be so careful. Every time you did it, I mean, your heart would just pound.
Their book looks at the Soviet era, and some of the spy craft may be a bit dated. But the espionage game goes on, says Oleg Kalugin. Many years ago, he was Vladimir Putin's boss at the KGB and says Putin's background is essential to understanding today's Russia.
Putin actually brought back some of the worst sides of the Soviet regime. Well, as a former KGB guy, his psychology, you know, is based on the old traditions of the Soviet system.
Speaking of the Soviet system, whatever happened to Party Marty Peterson and the Soviet source she handled? Well, after almost 2 years in Moscow, Peterson went to a bridge one night and hid a package for him. It included money, emerald jewelry, and a new camera. As she walked away,
I was accosted by these three men who grabbed me. They knew exactly where the package was, and there was a whole van full of people in suits.
They were KGB, and they took Peterson to their notorious headquarters, Lubyanka. She learned that her source, Trigon, whose real name was Alexander Ogorodnik, had been discovered 3 weeks earlier. When confronted, he said he would write a confession with his own pen.
This pen contained poison, which we, CIA, had provided to him as fulfilling his request to have a way to commit suicide, which he did at that time.
Peterson was kicked out of the Soviet Union, but worked another 26 years with the CIA. Before all these stories could be published, Tony and Jana Mendez had to submit their manuscript to the CIA for review, a lengthy process that came as his health was declining from Parkinson's disease.
They knew that Tony was not well, and I sent a note in saying, could you consider pulling our manuscript and putting it on the top of your pile, because I'd really like for him to know it's okay.
The CIA gave its approval this past January, one day before Tony Mendez died. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
It's NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air...
There is nothing that I won't do to defend what's mine.
Damian Lewis plays a ruthless hedge fund owner in Showtime's Billions. He also played a Marine sergeant in the series Homeland, King Henry VIII in Wolf Hall, and Army Major Richard Winters in the HBO series Band of Brothers. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Little Passports, a monthly subscription for kids ages 3 to 13, offering STEM packages designed to keep kids curious and learning all summer long and beyond. More at littlepassports.com/radio. From Subaru, committed to doing its part to make the world a better place by supporting philanthropic initiatives in local communities. Learn more at subaru.com/lovepromise. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. And from Focus Features with The Dead Don't Die, a comedy from director Jim Jarmusch about one town's fight against the zombie apocalypse, starring Bill Murray, Adam Driver, Tilda Swinton, and Chloe Sevigny, in theaters Friday.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Around 50 million Americans suffer from chronic pain. Wow, that's enough people to make a good-sized country all by themselves. Now, we typically think of pain as coming from an injury or an accident or an illness, and that does happen, but there can be another source. Studies show repeated exposure to trauma, anxiety, or depression, especially in childhood, can leave a physical imprint on the brain, which makes some people more vulnerable to feeling physically hurt, NPR's Patty Naiman reports.
Janine is 37 years old and lives in Burbank, California. She's suffered pain from head to toe since she was a child. We're not using her last name for reasons of privacy. Over the years, Janine's gone to dozens of doctors. X-rays and MRIs found no physical damage. She changed her diet, wore belts to correct her posture, and exercised to strengthen muscles. Nothing helped.
Lightning bolts kind of going up from my shoulders through my neck to my head. Then I also get this like grinding pain in my hips where I feel like I can't walk anymore. It's just very painful to walk.
She was eventually diagnosed with fibromyalgia, a disorder characterized by widespread pain throughout the body. The cause is unknown. Then about 8 months ago, a friend suggested a new type of therapy, emotional awareness and expression therapy, and Janine started writing in a daily journal.
That paragraph I wanted to share with you here...
In her journal, she looked backwards at the past when her health problems began.
I wrote down all the different health symptoms I've had throughout my life, pain-wise, but also other things.
Things that caused her distress. For Janine, who grew up in an abusive household, there was a lot to write down.
If I was dressed in a way that my dad thought was too provocative, like, it wasn't anything for him to call me a whore. Like, just say, well, you look like a whore today. Like, it just wasn't a thing. He'd call my mother that, too.
And the aggression was also physical.
Pushing, shoving, hitting, and certainly a lot of belts in childhood, so spanking, you know.
It didn't take much therapy for Janine to make a startling discovery. The backaches, stomach aches, and headaches she suffered in childhood came around the same time as the hitting and the yelling. As a young adult, she moved out of the house. The abuse stopped, but the pain didn't. Psychologist Mark Lumley at Wayne State University in Detroit says this is the case for a number of chronic pain patients.
There's a growing number of studies that have followed people prospectively over the course of years trying to predict who develops chronic pain. And they show clearly that difficult life experiences, adverse experiences in childhood, are later predictors of chronic pain and widespread pain years later.
So how does this happen? Amy Arnston is a neuroscientist at Yale Medical School. Under healthy conditions, she says, higher circuits in a part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, can regulate whether individuals feel pain and how much pain they feel.
But these higher brain circuits atrophy when we're exposed to chronic stress, especially stressors where we feel uncontrolled and frightened.
In other words, things like fear, depression, or anxiety can weaken these circuits. And if the circuits aren't working properly, then Arnston says people can feel more prolonged pain long after a physical injury has healed. And without proper regulation, the brain can also generate pain when there's no other physical damage.
the brain actually has pathways where it can go down and control our body and actually create a pain response.
And Arnston says this pain is real. It can happen to adults too, but when it starts in childhood, psychologist Lumley says it can set in motion a lifetime of chronic pain.
Most people don't necessarily outgrow so easily some of those difficult early childhood experiences. And even though one's life might look good now, people still remain haunted as memories of or thoughts about family come to the fore.
This is what happened to Janine at a specific time every day during the week.
Literally on the drive home, I would start getting pain. And so then you think, well, maybe it's because it's your long commute. You know, you are in the car for 45 minutes to an hour. Maybe it's your chair. So I had lumbar support. I had like heating elements.
But in therapy, she realized it wasn't the car or the commute. It was going home.
Nothing bad is meeting me here on the drive home. But when I was younger, you know, walking home, gutting home was like, oh, I got to go back there again. And it was just a dreadful feeling of now I have to go back to that environment. My house never felt like a safe place for me.
The idea that there was a connection between her pain today and the trauma she suffered during childhood just sounded, she says, kind of crazy.
To me, it just doesn't sound logical. You think about pain like something hits you, something hurts. But it's physical. It's not like something hits you emotionally and then something hurts.
But in fact.
That is the way it happens.
With emotional awareness and expression therapy, Janine learned how to confront what had happened to her as a child. Psychologist Mark Lumley and colleagues developed the therapy. He says it helps patients face emotions like anger, sadness, or loss of love that they may have suppressed at the time of abuse.
And part of facing it means talking about it. Giving it some expression with your words and your face and your body.
Because when you face it, you feel more in control. And you can actually repair the weakened pathways in the brain and make them strong again. Janine's psychologist, Laura Payne, says it wasn't easy.
It got very tough. And pain got a lot worse. And it became more persistent. And she continued, we just continued to push through with doing all the things that she, you know, supposed to be doing and engaging in what she would typically avoid. And we kind of got past that. But it was a hard time.
Much research still needs to be done, but Janine tells NPR's Patty Naiman the therapy worked for her.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from MD Anderson Cancer Center, where physicians treat all types of cancers with a team of nearly 21,000, all devoted to ending cancer and providing hope to patients. More at makingcancerhistory.com. And from Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults at home in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Learn more at 1-800-365-4189.
This is NPR News.
A Justice Department report found Alabama's prisons have the highest homicide rate in the nation. One inmate in that system heard our coverage and wrote us a letter. He says inmates have never felt so unsafe.
You never just felt like our life being in danger the way it is today. Basically, everybody incarcerated feels in danger.
A view from inside Alabama's prisons this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A key figure from the Watergate scandal will be testifying today before the House Judiciary Committee. NPR's Jim Howard says President Nixon's former White House counsel, John Dean, will appear as the committee continues to examine Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report.
Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler still wants former Special Counsel Robert Mueller to give open testimony on his Russia investigation report, and he says he'll subpoena Mueller if necessary. But having John Dean as the big-name witness today gives House Democrats the ability to draw comparisons between Richard Nixon and the Watergate scandal and President Trump on the issue of presidential obstruction.
Former Boston Red Sox slugger David Ortiz is recovering from a gunshot wound in his native Dominican Republic. Police say Ortiz was shot in the back last night at a bar in Santo Domingo. He's expected to recover. It appears Hong Kong will move forward with a plan to allow extraditions to mainland China. NPR's Rob Schmitz says hundreds of thousands of people turned out yesterday to protest.
The mass demonstration was one of the largest in Hong Kong's history, a stunning display of resistance to China's Communist Party and its efforts to erode civil liberties that have long set the former British colony apart from the rest of the country. People are worried Chinese authorities would use the law to send dissidents, activists, and foreigners to face trial in mainland courts, which are controlled by the Communist Party.
This is NPR News from Washington. It was 5 months ago a dam in Brazil gave way, killing more than 230 people. Now comes word from the Vale Mining Company it plans to spend nearly $2 billion to fix 9 dams in that country. Catherine Osborne reports.
The Brazilian dam that failed in January was one of the cheapest and most dangerous models in the iron mining industry. It's the same model as another nearby dam that burst 3 years ago. Then 19 people died in a river of mine waste containing mud and chemicals. With this money, Vale plans to deactivate 9 dams of this type or change them to a safer system. Vale's president says the company, the world's largest iron ore miner, is at a critical moment. Towns across Brazil in recent months have run evacuation drills after company warnings that other mines could burst. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Osborne in Rio de Janeiro.
No serious injuries are reported following a brush fire in Southern California, about 40 miles north of Los Angeles. It triggered panic and confusion yesterday among people at 2 nearby amusement parks, Six Flags Magic Mountain and the Hurricane Harbor Water Park. Hundreds of people hurried to the exits and parking lots when the fire and smoke became evident. Fire officials later told park guests to shelter in place. They moved them to the back of the property as crews battled the flames and roads were shut down. That brush fire burned about 40 acres in near 100-degree weather. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Alzheimer's Association, working toward a vision of a world without Alzheimer's, providing care and support to all those facing the disease with a commitment to advancing critical research. More at alz.org. From Fidelity Investments, taking a personalized approach to helping clients grow, preserve, and manage their wealth. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. The tariff battle with Mexico appears to be over, at least for now. But another front in the trade war is still wide open. The Trump administration is looking for a deal that would end tariffs on more than $200 billion worth of Chinese goods. Those measures and China's countermoves are starting to show new effects on the U.S. economy. NPR chief economic correspondent Scott Horsley is with us now. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Rachel.
So if you're a Chinese trade negotiator, what did you learn by watching President Trump in this particular dispute with Mexico?
The first thing to say, Rachel, is that there are limits to this analogy. Obviously, the trade battles with Mexico and China are not identical, so they do have to be weighed independently. But there's no question China is watching what happened with Mexico for clues about the president's negotiating style. And what clue they draw really depends on how you view the Mexican agreement that was struck last Friday. If you think Mexico caved, the message to China is Trump is serious and China better make some changes if it wants to get tariff relief. If, on the other hand, you think Trump backed down after Mexico essentially repackaged concessions it had already made, well, that's a roadmap that China itself has used in the past. Over the weekend, we also saw the president boasting on Twitter that Mexico is going to buy a lot of agricultural goods from the U.S. That's not anything new. Mexico was already a big customer, and so was China before this trade war all started. But that does suggest another path to win favor with President Trump is to buy a lot of farm products.
So we heard from the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin. He spoke to CNBC over the weekend. Let's listen to what he had to say.
We had a deal that was almost 90% done. China wanted to go backwards on certain things. We've stopped negotiating. And if China wants to move forward with the deal, we're prepared to move forward. If China doesn't want to move forward, then President Trump is perfectly happy to move forward with tariffs to rebalance the relationship.
What's going on there? I mean, have they really stopped negotiating?
They have. Remember, this all started with concerns in the U.S. about lack of intellectual property protection in China, the forced transfer of American technological know-how. Then last winter, Trump and Xi met. Chinese President Xi Jinping met in South America, and Trump agreed to delay escalating the tariffs while negotiators went to work on a deal. There were a lot of rounds of talks both in Washington and Beijing. There seemed to be some progress, but then last month the U.S. side accused China of backtracking. And since then, there haven't been any new talks. The higher tariffs have kicked in. There may be some disagreement going on within the Chinese government, just as there is here in this country, about which of those two paths Secretary Mnuchin laid out to follow.
Who specifically in the U.S. and China is hurting right now because of all this?
Well, both countries are paying a price. In fact, the whole world is paying a price. Last week, the World Bank, led by President Trump's hand-picked president, David Malpass, warned that trade tensions are hurting global growth. Here in this country, the Atlanta Federal Reserve Bank estimates the economy grew at an annual rate of just 1.4% in the current quarter, less than half the pace of growth in the first quarter. Of course, last Friday, we got that much weaker than expected jobs report. China is well aware of all this. In fact, there are some reports that Chinese negotiators took a harder line last month precisely because they thought the U.S. economy was weakening and that President Trump wouldn't have the stomach for an all-out trade war. Now, that may have been a miscalculation on China's part, but there's no question the trade tensions are taking a toll.
Now, these two leaders, Chinese President Xi Jinping and President Trump, are going to meet at the G20, right?
That's right. And, you know, usually there is a lot of groundwork done ahead of a high-level meeting like that. But that's not the way President Trump likes to operate. He prefers to improvise. So it's going to be Trump and Xi one-on-one. Buckle your seatbelts.
And NPR Scott Horsley. Thanks, Scott.
You're welcome.
Some other news now. Broadway celebrated a record-breaking season in terms of audience and box office with the Tony Awards last night. And two shows came up big, as Jeff London reports.
Broadway went to hell last night when Hadestown, a folk and blues-inflected retelling of the Orpheus myth, won 8 awards, including Best Musical. The show reimagines hell as a factory town run by a god who builds a wall around it. The musical was helmed by two women, singer-songwriter Anais Mitchell and director Rachel Chavkin. Both won awards, and Chavkin noted,
I wish I wasn't the only woman directing a musical on Broadway this season. There are so many women who are ready to go. There are so many artists of color who are ready to go. And we need to see that racial diversity and gender diversity reflected in our critical establishment, too. This is not a pipeline issue. It is a failure of imagination by a field whose job is to imagine the way the world could be. So let's do it. Thank you.
In the Best Play category, The Ferryman, Jez Butterworth's sprawling drama set in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, won 4 awards, including Best Play. It features a cast of 21, as well as a baby, a rabbit, and a goose. A radical reinterpretation of Rodgers and Hammerstein's classic Oklahoma was named Best Revival of a Musical. And in one of the night's most emotional moments, Ellie Stroker received Best Featured Actress in a Musical from her wheelchair. The 31-year-old lost the use of her legs after a car accident when she was 2 and plays the sexy Ado Annie in the revival.
This award is for every kid who is watching tonight who has a disability, who has a limitation or a challenge, who has been waiting to see themselves represented in this arena. You are.
Best Revival of a Play went to a 50th anniversary production of Mark Crowley's groundbreaking gay play, The Boys in the Band. Crowley got teary-eyed when he recalled the actors in the first production, most of whom died of AIDS.
And I'd like to dedicate this award to the original cast of 9 brave men who did not listen to their agents when they were told that their careers would be finished if they did this play. And they did it. And here I am. Thank you, all you.
The 83-year-old playwright was not the only senior to take a trophy home. 87-year-old Elaine May, who returned to Broadway after more than 50 years, won Best Actress as a grandmother with Alzheimer's in the Waverly Gallery, and 80-year-old Bob Mackey won for his costumes in the Cher Show. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
It's NPR News.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. An African-American Democratic lawmaker says she supports Louisiana's restrictive abortion law because there are too many abortions in her community.
I don't ever believe abortion should be the answer to poverty. I believe that as African-Americans, we should be fighting to make sure that we implement policies that give families livable wages, that make sure women have equal pay.
That view, next time on Here and Now.
Good morning, I'm Rachel Martin. A pizza place in California wants us to stop taking selfies during meals. Actually, they want us to stop texting, swiping, scrolling, all of it. And here's where it gets really crazy. Instead of looking at our phones, they want us to talk to each other. The Curry Pizza Company in Fresno wants any group of at least 4 people to lock away their cell phones when they come in. If you get through an entire meal, you get a free pizza, a triumph you will need to post about immediately. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab. Schwab believes in asking questions and being engaged. Charles Schwab, own your tomorrow. Learn more at schwab.com. From Visit St. Pete Clearwater, offering a downtown street mural scene, Chihuly Collection, Museum of Fine Arts, and the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art. More at visitstpeteclearwater.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation at wtgrantfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. The U.S. Constitution guarantees everyone accused of a crime the right to an attorney, even if they can't afford it. Sometimes, though, that doesn't happen. The ACLU has sued 15 states over inadequate public defense. Oregon could face a lawsuit next. Conrad Wilson of Oregon Public Broadcasting reports.
Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge Kathleen Daly is taking the bench in her seventh-floor courtroom in downtown Portland.
Good morning, everyone.
This is Treatment Court, a program for nonviolent offenders with drug-related arrests. Many defendants are meeting their attorneys for the first time.
Just make sure you talk with your lawyer. There's only a couple lawyers helping all of you, so they can only do one case at a time. So this process does take patience.
Several dozen defendants who are out of custody sit in rows of benches along the back, waiting their turn. Sheriff's deputies bring in a half dozen men. They're chained together, wearing blue jail scrubs.
He's going to be residing in Albany, Your Honor.
Casey Jones is an attorney for Metropolitan Public Defenders. The nonprofit provides legal services in the Portland metro area. She has 200 clients.
The people I'm representing are typically deep in their addiction, usually houseless.
Jones says she spends most of her week calling people, without much success, to make sure they show up to court.
As it is, my main goal is quickly assessing the cases so I know loosely what we're working with, and then trying to contact people.
That leaves little time for legal work. Earlier this year, a report from the nonpartisan Sixth Amendment Center outlined major issues with Oregon's public defense system, showing, in essence, the state was violating the U.S. Constitution. Oregon, like other states, has underfunded and overworked public defenders. David Carroll is the executive director of the Sixth Amendment Center.
When we got looking at how these contracts actually function, we really found some big problems.
Among the problems, Carroll says, is that the state pays a flat fee per case, no matter how complex, which essentially puts the financial interests of public defenders in conflict with the legal interests of their clients. In February, the state accepted that critique from the Sixth Amendment Center. Starting next year, Oregon will do away with flat fee contracting. A bill working its way through the legislature would go even further, codifying the changes in law. Over the course of several years, the state would essentially hire more than 900 public defenders and support staff.
We've had this system over 30 years where we've built in intentional opaqueness. We don't know what is out there.
Lane Borg runs the state's Office of Public Defense Services. He says anybody who really examines the system would have concerns.
They would not be comfortable with the compromises people have had to make in order to make an unsustainable system sustainable.
Borg's asking Oregon lawmakers for $50 million for the next 2 years. That money would only begin to fix the problem. And given all the pressure on the budget, lawmakers say they may not be willing to even fund that.
And I'm concerned.
Carl McPherson is the executive director of Metropolitan Public Defenders. He points out his clients are among society's most oppressed and marginalized, and that the state has record revenues.
We truly do not have equal access to justice in this country. We have two justice systems, one for the wealthy and the privileged, and one for those who are not.
The ACLU says they're watching the Oregon legislature closely and haven't ruled out the possibility of a lawsuit if it believes the state isn't putting enough money behind the plan. For NPR News, I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Thank you.
Trade tensions and economic growth, a connection?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Kronos, providing HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support them. Learn more at kronos.com/HR swagger.
I'm David Brancaccio in New York. Group of 20 finance ministers met in Japan this weekend, with many worrying aloud that trade tensions are hindering global economic growth. A dissenting voice, the U.S. finance minister, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who said, quote, "I don't think in any way that the slowdowns you're seeing in parts of the world are the result of trade tensions at the moment." Let's consider this more by turning to the BBC's veteran economics correspondent, Andrew Walker, in London. Good morning, Andrew.
Hello, David.
Is there a strong case that slowing growth around the world might be due to the U.S. taking this hard line on trade?
I'll stick my neck out, David. Normally one has to be, as a BBC correspondent, you have to be utterly balanced about these things. But yes, my view is that the tariffs are at the very least a significant drag on economic growth. The post-war expansion of the global economy that we've had was accompanied by, and many would say to a significant extent, driven by the removal of trade barriers and the expansion of international commerce. And so, yes, a situation where business decisions are being influenced either by the fact of tariffs or by the possibility that there might be more in the future means that decisions about where to produce things, what to produce, how much, are perhaps not going to be the best they could be.
Of course, it's not just trade tensions causing slowdowns hither and yon.
No, it's not just about trade. That's certainly true. But I find it hard to resist the conclusion that the slowing in global growth is not at least partly due to that.
Andrew Walker is the BBC's economics correspondent. Andrew, thank you.
My pleasure, David.
Checking markets, Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are each up 0.4%. Hong Kong closed up 2.3% amid the big political protests there. Three deaths of American tourists at one resort in the Dominican Republic are having a wider effect. Last month, a Pennsylvania woman died shortly after arriving at her hotel. 5 days later, a Maryland couple was found dead in the room of an adjacent resort. A medical investigation found respiratory failure contributed. News of this has travelers reassessing plans. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports.
This tourism commercial shows idyllic scenes of the Dominican Republic, white sand beaches and turquoise waters. It's made the country the top destination in the Caribbean with more than 6 million visitors a year, and led Virginia resident Keon Johnson to make plans to go with his buddy.
He and I both like cigars, so probably tour one of the tobacco factories. You know, just really celebrate on the beach.
He was about to book the trip when the news broke about the deaths.
We all came together like, you know, we need to pump the brakes on this trip.
Philadelphia resident Hamlet Garcia is seriously considering canceling his July booking, even though he's a frequent visitor to the country.
But I never expect this what happened right now. This is something that I heard happening in other countries.
But risk management specialist Anthony Roman thinks the travel industry probably won't feel long-term effects.
When it comes to remembering what element created risk, the American public have short-term reactions.
As for Keon Johnson, he's already looking into Jamaica for his Caribbean escape. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance, protecting commercial vehicles and offering specialized coverages designed to protect small businesses. More at progressivecommercial.com. And by Deloitte Private, delivering audits that are unique to you. Private company audits tailored to your business. Learn more at deloitte.com/us/audit-private.
Most, but not all, people buy stocks hoping they'll go up. So when they go up, those investors are happier. But a big story over the past 3 weeks has been the bond market soaring. Good, bad, or don't care. Well, I sat down with Washington Post columnist Alan Sloan to prompt him into a teachable moment here.
Good morning, David.
All right. So when some joker on the radio says the bond market is up, which has been one of the themes of June of 2019, I have been saying that a lot. Is that good or bad news to someone listening?
It depends.
Depends on what?
It depends on whether they own bonds. It depends on whether they own bond funds. It depends on whether they want to buy bonds or bond funds. It depends if they're buying a house. It depends if they're selling a house. I could do 20 other things, but we don't have time.
All right. So let's just highlight the difference between you hold a bond and you hold a bond fund. A bond, you hold it to maturity. That's the idea. And that could be many years.
Right. And you just buy the bond, you leave it alone, you collect the interest, you don't care what happens to the price, unless something horrible happens to the issuer, but that's not what we're talking about.
All right, so you don't care when I come on the radio and say the bond market is up or down if you hold a bond. But if you own a bond fund, a big collection of bonds run by supposedly a professional, maybe you do care.
Well, you shouldn't care. What'll happen in a bond fund is if interest rates go down, the shares of the bond fund will go up. If interest rates go up, the shares of the bond fund will go down. But again, what you're looking for is income on your shares, and you have to trust the manager to know what he or she is doing. And if you're going to sit there and twitch about interest rates every day, maybe you should run a bond fund instead of investing in one.
And look up what your bond fund is doing if you want to know, really, if it's good or bad for you. Now, you did mention another class of people who might be interested in the bond market's up, the bond market is down. Let's say you're thinking of borrowing to buy a house. Then, if bonds are up, its connected yield would be down, and that means interest rates are down.
Right. If the yield on Treasury securities goes down, generally, the interest rate on mortgages will go down, which is good for you if you want to buy a house. It's also good for the seller of the house because you'll presumably pay more than you would if the mortgage were more expensive.
And if you, like everyone else, wants to know why the bond yield moves opposite from the bond price, that'll be a different segment someday. Alan Sloan is also editor-at-large at ProPublica. Always good to see you.
My pleasure, David.
Now, on May 21st, the benchmark 10-year interest rate, the yield on the government's 10-year note, was up at 2.43%. It is just 2.14% this morning, meaning a lot of people have been buying bonds recently, some as a safe haven hedge against the uncertainties of the trade war. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.